This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The Radio EcoShock train is all booked up, ready to leave the station. We have two science reports: how we know the world will get hotter faster, and why sea levels along eastern North America went up a couple of inches in a single year. But first, I worry, how will we cope with the coming bottleneck when the economy crashes along with climate disruption? Are you ready inside?
Radio EcoShock.
Our next guest, Carolyn Baker, returns to Radio EcoShock. Carolyn is the author of many books, including Collapsing Consciously, Sacred Demise, and now a brand new look called Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, The Relationships We Need to Thrive. That's just out. She's been a former psychotherapist and currently offers life coaching. Carolyn and I share news stories, although I get a lot more than I give, being a subscriber to her amazing daily news service. We're kind of online friends, but we don't agree about everything. Here's the thing. I think humans are in for some terrible shocks in the future. We are badly prepared, mentally and emotionally, to handle what is coming. Carolyn has some really useful inside tech to help us deal, and we're going to need it. Carolyn Baker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you, Alex. It's good to be back. I appreciate being here.
Now, I suppose it's not polite for friends to start with criticism, but I do want my listeners to know that I don't agree that humans will go extinct this century. Can we still have a useful dialogue?
Absolutely, because there are so many unknowns. None of us knows anything with certainty about the future. If we look at science, it's not a pretty picture, and extinction looks pretty realistic. On the other hand, we don't know for sure, and we don't know when exactly that's going to play out or how. So I think we can have a great conversation just having divergent views of that.
Well, we certainly both agree that humans are approaching some kind of awful bottleneck due to multiple causes. We could include the impacts of climate change, the economy, maybe a new plague, and I shouldn't even laugh about that after Ebola. It's a terrible thing. Energy, food supply problems, and you talk about all that as well, don't you?
Absolutely, in all of my books, yes.
And I was on your site. I was looking through the video page and was surprised, and also not surprised, to find your interview with preparedness guru Chris Martinson. In my view, Chris probably has a lot of male listeners, some of them preppers with extra gold, food, and guns in the basement. But maybe they need you most. Do you know what I mean?
Well, a lot of people want to focus only on the economic aspects of this. I have a lot of clients in life coaching who come to me and they've just awakened to all of these things and they're really into preparing, you know, logistically preparing. And some people sit at their computers and they strategize, you know, well, climate change is going to be bad here, but not there. Maybe I should move to there. And how do I get all of my financial ducks in a row? Because the collapse of the economy is going to happen at a certain time in a certain way. And boy, I'm going to be prepared. And those things are wonderful. You know, we really need to be aware of these possibilities, but to keep in mind that they're only possibilities. Just like our conversation about near-term extinction. I think it's a good possibility, but it is a possibility. And so what I think is extremely important, whether we're talking about near-term extinction or we're talking about economic collapse or whatever, is we need to have the emotional and spiritual tools to help us live and live well. And I don't mean financially well, but emotionally and spiritually well in terms of our connections with each other and the Earth community in order to navigate whatever is in front of us.
I don't have your training, but it's my observation, Carolyn, that millions of Western people have become disengaged from fundamental human feelings. They experience emotions through characters on TV or in the movies and tend to laugh or cry on cue along with the soundtrack. Am I far off on that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And many people that I respect, my friend Clinton Callahan, who writes about the next culture, and many folks who are looking at the realities of our predicament, are saying that and I don't want to say the whole human species, but certainly the inhabitants of industrial civilization are, for the most part, not mature. And we need to grow up. I talk about in, I forget which book it is. Oh, it's Collapsing Consciously. I have a couple of chapters in there on the culture of two-year-olds and how do we grow up. And part of, I believe, the reason for this awful cataclysm that we're facing is to be a teaching moment. To teach us what it really means to be human, what it really means to connect with each other, what it really means to fall back in love with the earth again, what it really means to find meaning and purpose for our lives.
So let's say we have an economic crash and money becomes almost worthless, jobs disappear, and for some people that's happening right now, but if we had a major depression, millions of people may find their emotions are left back in the very childlike state you just described. We didn't get the opportunity to feel real grief from real life. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And one of the things that I am focusing on now, Alex, it's really kind of the high point of my work, is I'm focusing on providing a safe and supportive container for people to feel their grief. We are, all of us in industrial civilization, are carrying mountains of grief. Grief about personal losses and grief about the planet, whether we're aware of it or not. And so, you know, I'm offering a grief weekend workshops. There's going to be one coming up in June in Providence, Rhode Island, a whole weekend where we have an opportunity in a safe and supportive place to really get into our grief. And I see grief as a doorway to consciously experiencing all of our emotions in a mature and appropriate way.
And some people will sneer at what you're doing and at grief. Are we just protecting ourselves?
Well, you know, we have thousands of engraved messages in this culture not to get near our grief. And so when people sneer about this, what I know is that they're scared. What I know is that they are a product of a culture that says grief is weak, grief is silly, it's unnecessary, you know, man up, woman up, you know, start doing, take action instead of grieving. And taking action and doing are very important, but not without the grieving process.
Well, it just seems obvious that an event or a period where millions of people will die is coming, possibly this decade, certainly during the next, and I don't know if it'll be famine or just too many reasons why our population is unsustainable. What happens to the survivors, especially if they witness it all on TV, as we're already doing with places like Vanuatu that was wiped out by a great storm and other places that are in trouble already?
Well, this is what I write about in my books. I started writing about it in Sacred Demise, and then I got much more into that very thing in Navigating the Coming Chaos. But absolutely, we're going to all be experiencing some kind of PTSD just by watching these things and feeling all that's going on around us is chaos. It will be very, very distressing. And that is precisely why we need the emotional tools to help us navigate this. And we need support from each other. We need connection with each other. Those are two things that I think we absolutely must have in order to get through this intact.
Yeah, just think of the lasting emotional scar left by the 5 million human-caused deaths in the Holocaust during World War II. And now we picture millions of people dying due to our wasteful lifestyles, burning carbon, overusing pesticides and antibiotics, and filling the ocean with plastic. And I'm so glad you raised PTSD, because that's exactly what I'm thinking. It could come on a big social scale, and I wonder what that would look like, a society that's experienced PTSD.
Well, we did here in the United States actually experience some of that after 9/11. We were terribly in shock. We were terribly traumatized. And, you know, what was really positive in all of that is that for a few days, there was mourning. There was deep introspection. There were all these memorials that were created. There was grieving. There was people staying home with their families and coming together with each other. And then George W. Bush told us to go shopping. And right away, the United States says, we've got to invade Afghanistan. So, you know, that grief stream was broken by people who want to do anything but grieve. But I think, you know, that watching this kind of PTSD and experiencing it, being in the middle of it, has the potential to bring that sort of positive reunion once again among all of the terrible things that it will bring forth.
Well, the idea of the medical diagnosis of shock is partly why I called this program Radio EcoShock. I think people will go into a state of shock as the environment unravels from the stresses we've created. Can you picture that?
Well, absolutely. And I love it that you have shock in your title, because we need to be shocked. You know, my friend Andrew Harvey says that we're living in Coca-Coma. You know, we're in this coma from the corporate world, from the media, from all of the denial that we're steeped in every single day, that life is just wonderful. And, you know, we're, the United States especially, we're an exceptional country. We have nothing to worry about. You know, the big mantra is, it'll get back to normal. It always does. And so there's this numbness and this delusion and this just complete oblivion to what's actually going on. So, yes, we need to be shocked in many, many ways.
And this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Carolyn Baker, author of the new book, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse. There is another possibility, and that is the direction you take. We could learn to grieve and survive. How can grief help us get through these things?
Well, in many indigenous cultures, and I am going to answer your question here, but I want to mention that in many indigenous cultures, grief is really honored and respected. And one culture that I'm specifically familiar with about this is the Dagara tribe of West Africa, where they have grieving rituals all the time. In fact, they have a funeral once a week, even if nobody dies, because they understand that grief that is not expressed, that is not felt, that is not shared with the community is toxic to the community. And so what happens is, as we grieve and as we get support from each other to do that, many, many things that could become toxic and become divisive in the community are cleansed, are healed, and people really deeply connect around the grieving process.
I guess a key question for me and for our listeners will be, how will we stop grieving and what follows next?
Well, that's a concern that a lot of people have. Because we're so afraid of grieving, we think that if we go into it, we'll never stop. And, you know, we'll end up being clinically depressed, and then we'll want to kill ourselves, and on and on and on. The truth is, if we don't grieve, that is when we are likely to get depressed. Because, as my friend Francis Weller says, depression is often unmetabolized grief. And so I see grief as a doorway to wholeness. You know, we grieve for a while, and then the body just naturally stops, and it stands back, and it takes a break, and then we grieve some more, and this process goes on. And in the grieving workshops, ceremonies that I do, we follow the whole thing up with a time of joy and celebration, because when you release all this toxicity, the body is much lighter, and then you're much more available emotionally to experience the other emotions. And joy just naturally follows. You know, William Blake said, the deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy. And so after we finish the grieving piece, then we go into celebration, we go into connecting with each other, we go into gratitude, sharing poems, sharing songs, laughing, and having a really good time. So going into grief does not mean that we're going to get stuck there.
And your new book takes yet another direction. It's about love and about relationships. And I know you, this isn't new for you. You've been counseling people, especially, as you say, those newly aware of the coming challenges. You've been doing that for some time. Does your book build on those experiences?
Yes, it absolutely does. As a matter of fact, the first chapter deals with what many people come to me initially about to discuss, which is living with a reluctant partner, perhaps a partner or a family member even, who just doesn't want to hear about the collapse of industrial civilization and all these other things. And so the person comes to me and says, I just, you know, can't share anything with this person. They don't want to hear it. This is such a huge part of my life. What am I going to do? And so chapter one gives some of the tools that I use in workshops and in coaching people as to how to deal with loving, living, and preparing with a reluctant partner. And then in the second chapter, I start talking about children and raising children in this planetary predicament. And I have a wonderful appendix at the end of the book by a woman named Amanda Whitman in Vermont that has a three-part article series on raising kids for a resilient future. And then chapter three, I go into talking about relating with family, friends, and community. Some very specific tools are given in the book.
Do you think it's harder to find friends and lovers now as the media and the economy encourage us to sit in the silos of our office and then on the couch in front of the TV?
Well, yes and no. We are profoundly isolated, but there's also a huge push in this culture to be with somebody and, you know, not to be introspective. In our isolation, we're not doing inner work. We're just like staring at a computer screen or distracting. But there's the other side too, the messages that we get in this culture to be with somebody, you know, that, and it's wonderful if we can be in a partnership that is supportive, where we agree on things and where we're working together for the well-being of ourselves and the world. But I think there's too much relationship addiction in this culture that doesn't allow us to find out who we really are.
Good point. Now, I know you lost a friend and in the process learned more about the hospice experience. How does that apply to all of us in this world we live in?
Well, I don't think anyone needs to accept the notion of near-term extinction to understand that we are living in a hospice situation, because so much of our planet is dying. And as we see the increase in environmental illnesses, we're going to, I think, and already are, starting to see a lot of death and a lot of long-term illness. Cancer is now epidemic. So we're living in a time of really being, I think, in planetary hospice. But as I say in many places, hospice is not the worst place we could be. In fact, some people say it's been the best experience of their lives, because it can give us, especially if we have a hospice attitude toward all of this, it can give us an opportunity to deeply reflect, on who we are and what our lives mean. It's a time where we can connect with others and really experience deep level connection with people, a time to fall deeply in love with the earth, a time to serve and give as we have never given before, a time to love as we have never loved before, and maybe a time to make amends to people that we've harmed. So, you know, hospice, I think, is just a tremendously heightened awareness about what's important. And we shouldn't get all hung up on, oh, that means we're all going to die. Well, yeah, we all are going to die, and we're dying as we speak. So let's deal with it like grown-ups.
I'm always interested, Carolyn, in how aware people use the media to get their message out. Tell us about the changes in your radio show, The Lifeboat Hour.
Now I'm back at Progressive Radio Network, and I'm very happy to say that starting this Friday, March 27th, at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to have the Lifeboat Hour coming back to life in a live show where we're taking callers.
Great. I think the live shows are really exciting when you do them. So how do people find you on the web or on Facebook, and what should they expect when they do find you?
Well, they can find me at my website, which is www.carolynbaker.net. And they can find me, of course, on Facebook. I have a couple of pages on Facebook. I have my regular page. And then I have another page that we just started in anticipation of the grief weekend that we're doing in June. And I really want people to go to my Facebook page and look at that weekend workshop page, which is called The Gifts of Grief, Grief as Sacred Work.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about or a message you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I want to really encourage people to read my book, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, because it covers so much material. It covers 16 different kinds of relationships that we need to cultivate in order to thrive and live passionately in this time of planetary hospice.
And you always mix so many other sources and quotes in your work that I think it's almost like a doorway where people can walk out in a lot of different directions. So I always appreciate that in your work. Our guest is a historian. She's an author. She's a life counselor and speaker, Carolyn Baker from carolynbaker.net. She calls it speaking truth to power, and she certainly does. You may disagree with a few things, but friends, I predict you will someday need what she teaches. We all will. Thank you so much for talking with us, Carolyn.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find links for today's program and my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists have predicted how hot Earth can become, depending on our greenhouse gas emissions, of course, but they seldom say how quickly that happens, or how it will develop in the region where you live. As biologists can tell you, when it comes to survival of the species, the rate of warming may be as important as the final temperature. What's true for animals and plants is just as true for humans and our ability to adapt our civilization. Speed matters. That's why I welcome a new paper titled Near-Term Acceleration in the Rate of Temperature Change. The lead author is Dr. Stephen J. Smith, a past author with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and currently a scientist with the Joint Global Change Research Institute of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Maryland. That's part of the U.S. Department of Energy. He joins us now. Stephen Smith, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
Steve, how would you introduce your paper to an educated listener?
Well, we looked at how fast temperatures change over time due to both human and natural influences, and we focused this work on the rate of change over 40-year periods. So what that means, if you looked over four decades of data, what was the average change over that whole period? And the reason we focus on that time period is that temperatures in any particular place, say here in North America, vary from year to year due to internal variations in the climate system. And I suspect most of your listeners heard of La Niña, El Niño, and so on. And so by looking over a longer time period, we found we could look beyond the immediate impacts of the shorter-term fluctuations and see what was going on in terms of a slightly longer-term trend.
So most scientific models focus on how hot the Earth will become as the global mean temperature increases. Why should we be just as concerned about the rate of increase?
Well, the rate of increase tells us how fast we would have to adapt to any changes. So one example that people might be familiar with is growing zones. So there's organizations that put out these zones that tell you, give you some indication of what types of plants are suitable for your climate. And, for example, in your yards or orchards or gardens. And the rate of temperature change, if this is changing, this tells you how quickly these zones are going to shift. And if these shifts occur faster, we're going to have to adapt to those shifts more quickly. That also applies to human systems. So, for example, if the climate changes, different crop varieties or different crops might need to be planted by, any particular farmer on their land because they can't move their land. Their land is there, and they're going to have to adapt to whatever changes happen. And in the United States, of course, we have some pretty smart farmers who can adapt to changes, but they also have a lot of information and resources available to them. Agricultural extension, a lot of information and technology. But a particular concern as climate is changing are, for example, farmers in poorer countries. So they don't have these resources, so it may be much harder for them to adapt to these changes.
Is it fair to say that your research shows the rate of temperature increase is speeding up, that we will get hotter faster?
Yes. What we found is these climate models project that we're on the cusp right now of a new state of climate where the models are projecting that the rate of change will soon start to speed up and be outside of the range that we saw historically. So what we see, to get to the other part of your question, is that looking at these sort of four-decade periods, that the rate of change sped up over the last several decades and then flattened out over the last few years. So looking at the past 40 years from today, for example, temperatures have still increased, but at a relatively constant rate over the last few segments of time. But that rate's also getting close to the high end of what we've seen historically already.
So, Steve Smith, other forecasts like the IPCC tend to look at climate developing over a century. That's a pretty long time. How was your team able to get a snapshot of what might happen in 40 years, and that's a time frame that seems more real for humans?
Well, we really used the same data as used by other scientists, but we just looked at it in a new way. And what we found was it was hard to distinguish the human-driven trends from natural variability if you looked at rates of change over, say, a two-decade time horizon. But once we got out to a 40-year span, you could see these changes come out up above this natural variability.
And what is the range of possible heating your paper predicts for the next 40 years?
What we found, for example, in North America was that in the near term, the model showed a range from about 0.7 to 1.8 degrees centigrade over a 40-year period up to about the near term. And that's about 1 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit over that period.
That's quite a bit because we were trying to stay under 2 degrees. We've already warmed almost 1 degree. If we get 1.8, we're over the safe limit.
Well, that 2 degrees refers to 2 degrees of, or what people often talk about is 2 degrees of global temperature. But regional temperatures, say in North America, the northern hemisphere tends to warm a little quicker than the Earth as a whole. So it's getting closer, it's true.
Okay, now how does what you've predicted compare to the past 1,000 years of Earth's temperature as we know it?
Well, over the past century or two, what's happened is temperatures sort of fluctuate. They go up and down. So looking at the past 1 or 2,000 years, looking at these reconstructions, what we found was regional temperatures in, say, Europe and Asia and so on would fluctuate. They would go up or down maybe 0.8 degrees or maybe up to maybe a degree over a 40-year period. But what was happening is sometimes it would go up, sometimes it would go down, and there was not a lot of roughly equally likely over that period to get rates of increase or rates of decrease.
Is there any way that you could address uncertainties like the possibility, say, an economic collapse which slashes fossil fuel emissions or a big cut in urban air pollution resulting in global dimming and maybe a rapid jump in temperatures? Can you factor those things in?
Well, we can. What we do for those sorts of things is we look at different scenarios of the future. So when we look at the human system, which is what you're talking about, we don't say we can predict the future. You know, there's no physical laws that govern what human beings will decide to do or how technology will develop. So what we do is different scenarios. So these scenarios actually all included decreases in air pollution in these scenarios. So what we assumed was that as countries' incomes go up, then they would pay increasing attention to cutting air pollution. So there wasn't a sudden decrease, but it did decrease over time. So that factor is in there. We don't have a scenario that is some sort of economic collapse. That sort of scenario is not very common for people to try to do, although we did look at a scenario where greenhouse gas emissions were cut very significantly over the next decade, even over the next 50 years. So that's sort of a low-end scenario of what would happen in the future. So we did look at a range of possibilities.
Okay. Now, new science has emerged pretty recently predicting that heat sinks like oceans and forests may not function as well in the coming decades. Do the climate models you used factor this in?
Well, these types of effects in general were included in the CO2 concentrations that were used to drive these models. Now, these models, the design of the scenario process was such that they all use the same carbon dioxide concentration pathway. So there's uncertainty in exactly these things that you're mentioning. So it's possible that the effects could be somewhat higher or lower than the central result, depending on how these things play out. We didn't try to estimate that, but I think it would have a more impact further out in the century because these feedbacks tend to be sort of accumulate over time. So I wouldn't expect the differences in the assumptions about CO2 feedbacks to have a large impact in this near-term rate of change that we were focusing on.
Another point that you raised in the paper is that regions do matter. In fact, in the paper, Near-Term Acceleration in the Rate of Temperature Change, we find this quote, "Although global temperature trends are the most commonly used metrics of climate change, climate impacts will be driven by regional trends. Why do regional results matter as much or more than global forecasts?"
Global trends are a useful metric to think about how much change is happening, and this 2-degree number you mentioned has, you know, in a lot of people's minds. But it's really the trends in specific locations that are most relevant for impacts, because that's where the impacts happen. So by looking at regional trends, we're a step closer to where people live or where our forests or croplands are that will be experiencing these changes.
You already told us about the effects in North America, possibly. What about Europe?
Well, Europe was actually fairly similar to North America, and this is a general effect that the Northern Hemisphere, you know, climate tends to happen in the hemispheres or latitudinal bands. So North America and Europe were fairly similar and both above the global average, and that's a general effect that we've known for some time.
And speaking of above the average, the Arctic is already fantastically warmer the past few years. Will it get even warmer even faster?
Yes, that is something we saw in the Arctic, and it was rather striking that the model showed a range of about 1 to 3 degrees centigrade over 40-year periods over this near term, and even higher rates in the following couple of decades, so it was quite large.
What are the predictions about warming rates in the other hemisphere, in Australia or New Zealand, for example?
Well, I have to say, I didn't pull out the numbers for Australia. We were focusing on comparing with these long reconstructions for the past, and it so happened we didn't have one available for there. But the southern hemisphere in general tends to warm at a slightly lower rate than the global average, and it's the opposite of the northern hemisphere. And that's because most of the southern hemisphere is ocean, so you have more buffering effect with the ocean stabilizing temperatures and more of that heat going into the ocean. Conversely, the northern hemisphere has more land mass, and that land doesn't really absorb heat, so that land mass tends to heat faster. So there's this general difference between time scale of response between the northern and summer hemispheres.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, scientist Stephen J. Smith from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Maryland. We're talking about the speed of temperature increase on planet Earth. Steve, as is common for such scientific projections, your team calculated a range of possibilities. What would you say the best case scenario is, and then what is the worst case?
That's another interesting question, and let me just give a little statistics. What we did is we showed the 90% range over the climate model. So over this set of climate models that all ran this scenario, we showed the results that happened, the range of results that happened 90% of the time. So there are some results that happened outside of that range, and I think that might be sort of this best or worst case. And we didn't really look into those. We did this 90% range because that we wanted to present a range that we considered fairly robust. So if you wanted to get into this consideration of the best and worst case, then what you need to do is look at those smaller number of scenarios that were outside this range where most of the models were. You need to carefully evaluate how realistic those scenarios are, what the mechanisms were that resulted in that either much better than average or much worse than average result, and then probably also consider how well those models simulated the historical period. So we actually didn't do that, but it's an interesting question.
I noticed in your paper, it discusses what happens under a rate of change of 4.5 watts per meter squared. And to be honest, that's not easy for any of us to understand. What does that mean, and who is using that standard?
Right. Well, that's good. So what this scenario is, it's a standard scenario. So what was done was a set of four scenarios were developed for all the climate models to run. And this particular scenario we took as a case we focused on, but as I mentioned, we looked at some other ones as well. And so this is a scenario that refers to radiative forcing, and that's something measured in watts per meter squared. So first I have to talk about that. So radiative forcing, what this is a measure, it's how much extra heat that our changes to the atmosphere are trapping in the Earth system. So if you look at the top of the atmosphere, how many watts per square meter, that's like watts like a light bulb, so how many watts per square meter are being trapped? Now, 4.5 watts per square meter, that's a scenario that stabilizes at that much extra heat being trapped by the end of the century. And it doesn't sound like a lot. It's actually a fairly small number, except when you integrate that over the whole of the Earth, that's enough to change our climate quite significantly. So that's what that is. So it's a scenario where it was assumed that the world takes action to control carbon dioxide emissions, and that carbon dioxide emissions stabilize. They peak about in about 20 years from now, and then they go down such that by the end of this century, by 2100, global CO2 emissions are, I think, half or a third below what they are today. So we've taken some significant actions to change that trajectory.
Now, what about the recently observed slowdown of warming? Does your research predict that, and if not, why not?
That's another good question. So first, we can talk a little bit about this slowdown. So as you implied, if we look at the global surface temperatures, the records generally show that the surface temperatures have increased over what they were, but they haven't been increasing very much over the past several years. And there's a lot of research going on in this slowdown, what's causing it. And we still have a fair bit to learn, but in my reading of this, there seems to be a bit of a developing consensus on a couple of things. One thing, we're certain that we're still adding extra heat to the Earth system. Greenhouse gases are still accumulating. But a large part of what happened lately seems to be that this extra heat is going into the oceans and deeper into the oceans. So instead of this extra heat heating up near the surface, it's ending up deeper in the oceans. So the question is really, why is this happening? And this is something that, like I said, a lot of people are really looking into this, and I don't think we have a complete answer yet, but there's increasing evidence that this is, at least in large part, somewhat a chance event. For example, a chance combination of some of these different modes of variability. So there was a recent paper on this that was looking at that. So to circle back to your original question, if this is a chance event, we've got these modes of variability going on that are happen to be drawing extra heat into the ocean instead of letting it go in the atmosphere, then when you run a climate model, when you get that model gets to 2015, then there's not much chance it will have one of these events right in 2015, you know, at the right time, since it's just a chance thing. So when people look at longer climate model runs, they do see this sort of slowdown so that these things happen. So what we need to understand is understand the mechanism behind this and understand what the probability is. Is this a 1 in 100 type of event? Is this something that happens more often, less often? And then we will be able to put this in the context of these results and these probabilities.
Another key point I found in your paper is the concept that as this century progresses, the human fingerprint on climate change becomes easier to see. Right now, we have a hard time seeing that a certain violent storm or heat wave is due to human emissions rather than the natural cycles or variations you've just talked about. Will that become clearer by 2040 or 2050?
Well, that's really a question that's really a leading research question in climate science, and it's really a question about attribution and probabilities. And you're asking, you know, how can we say what caused a certain event? And the way most of us tend to think about this is that what we would want to be able to say is that what was the probability of this event occurring before humans started changing the atmosphere, and how much did that probability change? You know, it could go up or down. And I think a lot of this, I think we'll get increased knowledge of this, but also the statistics might change. So what's happened is there's work that's already going on for heat waves. So this is where we're starting to be able to do a little bit of this, where people are trying to estimate what the probability of a heat wave occurring and if there was an increased probability due to climate change. So we're just starting to be able to do this. And I think heat waves will probably be an area where we'll be able to do this the easiest. We have more data. We have these long, you know, millennial records to look at. Doing this for storms is more difficult, so it might take a little longer for us to be able to understand enough to be able to do that, answer your question.
In most cases of science, we do need a baseline, a standard case, to detect real changes. I'm guessing from your conclusions that the science of what is normal is still being developed. Or is there a normal in these natural systems?
Well, it depends what piece you're looking at. So, for example, for the surface temperature, we do have these long records, which gives us a lot more, really a better idea about what, you know, what normal might be. And it does fluctuate. But what we're able to do with those records is get a sense of how much they fluctuate. And I might mention one of the first things we did in their paper was we compared those records of fluctuations with what the climate models did, and they agreed fairly well. So that gave us more confidence in what the climate models are doing. So for temperature, I think we can have a fairly good sense. But for something like rainfall, it's a lot harder. Rainfall is more sporadic. It's actually harder to measure today. There's places in the world where we actually don't have good measurements of rainfall. We certainly don't have good measurements over as long of time. So I think understanding what's normal for rainfall is a little harder.
Can I assume from this paper that climate change will be an increasing problem for the foreseeable future, a kind of project that lasts for centuries?
Well, at least through the 21st century, yes. It's going to depend on what humans decide to do, how long it goes after that.
So I guess we're such a great variable that it's difficult to say what the state of the world climate might be in 2200 or 2300. Can we go that far ahead yet?
Well, we can do projections, but as you said, the uncertainties get bigger. And the uncertainty in what humans will be doing certainly is a big piece of that. And, you know, if emissions keep increasing, you get increasing uncertainties on how the system will respond.
Steve Smith, these scientific papers take quite a while to research, review, and publish. I'm presuming you've moved on. What are you researching these days?
Well, I'll just mention one project, which is we're working to develop more up-to-date estimates of historical emissions of things like aerosols and pollutant emissions. And this is a pretty exciting project for me because we're bringing together researchers and data providers from around the globe to improve our understanding of our emissions into the atmosphere and how humans have been impacting the environment.
We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen J. Smith from the Joint Global Change Research Institute of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Maryland. The new paper, Near-Term Acceleration in the Rate of Temperature Change, was published in the journal Nature Climate Change on March 9, 2015. Steve, thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find links to the science we've been talking about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Sea level rise has been called the single greatest impact of climate change. But if we are learning, sea level can go up regionally for other reasons. Surprising new research shows the ocean rose along the coast of New England, for example, by almost 4 inches for a couple of years. Here to explain why is Paul B. Goddard. He's working on his PhD in climatology and climate modeling at the University of Arizona. More recently, Paul was the lead author of a paper in the journal Nature Communications that was titled An Extreme Event of Sea Level Rise Along the Northeast Coast of North America in 2009-2010. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
There were several surprises for me in your new paper. First of all, though, what stimulated you to do this research?
Sure. My advisor, Zhengjin Yin, has actually looked at this type of process occurring in climate models. So he knew that when a study came out in 2012 showing a decrease in the ocean circulation, he knew from his climate model study that this may mean increased sea level rise along the East Coast. So when we had the observations of the ocean circulation changing, he had me look to see if there was a signal on the Northeast Coast in the actual observations of the tide gauge data. So that's how we began.
And how much did the ocean go up around New England starting in 2009?
Yeah, so we calculated from New York City up to Newfoundland, the average increase in the 2 years from 2009 to 2010 was about 94 millimeters, with the highest being 128 millimeters at Portland, Maine. this was quite a significant increase. We didn't find anything like this in the record dating back to the early 1900s.
Wow, that's almost 5 inches at the highest point there. Well, surely local fishermen and other officials noticed such a big rise in the seas. Were there any impacts?
Yeah, so we looked through some of the literature that had been written up, and most of the studies that showed, you know, coastal erosion or flood inundation along the coast, they were mostly studied in the North Carolina region or Maryland, but nothing much north of New York City. I'm not sure if it was just, you know, less people looking there for a signal, but actually from our research, this area north of New York City actually got more of the signal than what was in the Mid-Atlantic region, which was getting most of the press. So that was a little strange to find.
So here's my first surprise. I've been told by experts, including scientists on Radio EcoShock, that the major cause of sea level rise in places like New York City was subsidence, that the land was still sinking along the coast after the glaciers departed. Is coastal New England sinking, and how does that relate to what you found?
Yeah, so coastal New England, as well as down the Mid-Atlantic region, there is some land subsidence, either due from the past glacial maximum, you know, the retreat of the glaciers, or from groundwater pumping and things. And it's a really big issue in the Chesapeake Bay region. However, these changes are only on a few millimeters per year. And what we saw from 2009 to 2010, again, it was like a change of about 40 to 50 millimeters per year. So a full order of magnitude larger. So therefore, the land subsidence cannot explain everything that was happening during this time.
Well, that brings me to the second most important point, I think, and that's just how complicated assigning the causes of sea level rise can be. If it wasn't subsidence, what did cause New England seas to go up those 128 millimeters or 5 inches in some places?
Yeah, so we tied it to two different things in the climate system. One was the actual ocean circulation in the Atlantic slowing down, as well as atmospheric changes in the North Atlantic, which changed wind patterns over that. And I feel we can get into that a little bit further on.
Okay. Now, do climate scientists add in ocean circulation, like you've been talking about, in their models, like the ones used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Yeah, the climate models that are used by the IPCC are fully coupled, so they have fully interactive ocean atmosphere, and they do a fairly good job of representing the circulation across the entire globe, and this IPCC report uses the best results out there, and it's the best conclusions we have thus far, but, you know, we're always working towards making the models better.
All right, Paul Goddard, I'm assuming your work is closely related to another paper, and that's the one in Ocean Science led by H.L. Bryden. The title is Impact of a 30% Reduction in Atlantic Meridional Overturning During 2009-2010. Scientists call that AMOC for short, and that's certainly easier to pronounce. Please explain what Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation is.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or like you said, AMOC, is the circulation that travels in the Atlantic Ocean, travels from the south at the surface, across the equator, and actually the Gulf Stream is part of the AMOC, so that warm water off the Atlantic coastline is part of the AMOC, the Gulf Stream. And then as the Gulf Stream heads north, it loses some heat, and when it gets up into the Labrador Sea and the Greenland Sea and the Iceland Sea, it's become cold enough and dense enough that it can sink. And this sinking is what is part of the overturning part, the overturning as far as going from the surface towards the bottom of the ocean. And then it returns to the South Atlantic and all the way down to the Southern Ocean where Antarctic is at depth. So that's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. And its relationship to the sea level rise event is if you picture the Gulf Stream flowing away from the coastline, to your right is to the south and to the left is to the north, and there's actually quite a steep sea surface height gradient between the two. And if that sea surface height gradient decreases at all, there is a change in the sea level height on the coastline. So that's what actually we saw in 2009 and 2010 was this decrease in the gradient or the decrease in the AMOC strength, which caused an increase in sea level rise. So it is kind of a tongue twister to get through it all, but it's all there.
I was astounded to find in that Bryden paper that this North Atlantic ocean current system is, quote, accounting for 25% of the maximum combined atmosphere-ocean heat transport necessary to balance the Earth's radiation budget, end quote. 25% is a huge number. What happens if this system slows down?
Yeah, that's one of the rare things about the Atlantic circulation is how much heat it does transport northward. You know, a lot of people may be familiar with the idea that the Gulf Stream brings heat to Europe. And so a change in the Gulf Stream flow, you know, may change the heat transport in that region as well. So, you know, the flow is going to always happen as long as there are winds, because winds push the currents around. But any kind of change in the net heat transport could definitely dramatically change the heat budget of the entire Earth.
Right. And getting back to your own paper, Paul Goddard, has the sea level now gone down around New England?
Yeah, so basically at the current state, it is below where the peak was in 2010. However, it's still higher than where it started off at in 2008. And so what we studied was basically this huge fluctuation that happened between 2008 and 2010. So the long-term trend of the sea level rise is still increasing. However, the year-to-year fluctuation can be superimposed on that, and that's what we were looking at.
I think you mentioned this, but how rare is such a big sea level change driven by changes in ocean circulation?
Yeah, so one of the fascinating things that we found was if you looked at the number, that 94 millimeters in 2 years along the northeast coast, that statistically is equivalent to a 1-in-850-year event. So, in other words, very rare for something like that to happen.
Do climate models show this kind of event becoming more rare or happening more often?
Yeah, so with the climate models, we looked at some experiments that basically look at a doubling of the CO2 in the atmosphere, which, you know, we project that to occur towards the end of this century from 2070 to 2100. So with this increase of CO2, we do expect the sea level extreme events that we saw in the Northeast to increase in frequency and in magnitude.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with scientist Paul Goddard from the University of Arizona. You also credit a second force, as you mentioned, or a cycle for this historic sea level burst around New England, and that's the Significant Relative North Atlantic Oscillation Index, another tongue twister. Please explain what that is and what happened.
Yes, and I'll try to make this as simple as I can. So the North Atlantic Oscillation is an atmospheric mode, and it deals with air pressure differences in the North Atlantic. And the easiest way to think of this is when the North Atlantic is in a negative mode, like it was during the 2009-2010, it means that winds along the northeast shore of North America are either blowing towards the coastline or along the coast. And both of those result in net transport of water to the coast, or in other words, kind of pushing the waters up to the course to the coast, making a sea level rise.
I think that makes sense. I can understand that. Well, now, another key reason I thought your paper was important is this. What if ocean circulation brings another big hike in sea levels at the same time as a big storm surge event like Hurricane Sandy? Wouldn't Sandy flooding have been worse if it had happened in 2009 or 2010?
Yeah, of course. Basically, any time that you superimpose a storm on a high tide or sea level extreme event like this, you're going to end up with more coastal inundation and extreme impacts. So I would say yes with that.
All right. So it's important that we know about these things because they could affect a lot of human lives. I have to ask you, Paul, why are you at the landlocked University of Arizona working on ocean levels?
Yeah. So when I looked around at graduate programs, the one at U of A, they actually have a really good climate modeling group here, which is unusual for a university. Most of the climate modeling groups are run by industry such or government agencies such as NCAR or GFDL in Princeton. But here at the University of Arizona, we actually have the capabilities of running climate models. So it was very interesting to find that out, as well as some amazing climate scientists out here already, such as my advisors, Jun-Jin Yin and Joellen Russell and Jonathan Overpeck, and the list goes on and on. It's just a great place to do climate research out here. And a sea level rise should be a concern everywhere, so it doesn't really matter if you're along a coast or not.
Well, again, on a personal level, I'm finding more cases where PhD candidates are putting out cutting-edge research, often as lead authors. We've had three of them, in fact, this year on the show. Even before getting a doctorate or becoming a professor, do you think that's a new trend, or what does it tell us about science?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that come to mind. I think, one, there's just so many questions to be answered right now in the climate system. Things are changing at, you know, an accelerated rate, something that we haven't seen in the past, as well as we have the technology now to understand them and hopefully get the public and policymakers, you know, in line and involved in these types of investigations. So that's certainly one of the major things. I would say that young science or young climatologists have a very bright future.
Well, to be blunt, I think it's also a case where it used to be that the PhD candidates did the work and then the lead author name went to whoever was in charge. And I think that's changing too, that people are saying, well, okay, you're doing the work, you're getting your name on the paper.
Yeah.
Now, the whole subject of how the ocean works is coming into a kind of renaissance. It seems to me, Paul, we're coming to appreciate at least two things: how much we don't know about the ocean, and that the ocean is probably the single biggest factor driving climate in the coming centuries. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the ocean is Earth's pacemaker. You know, it covers 70% of the land. It's the large reservoir for heat as well as CO2 gas. It's really what on long-term scales affects the climate system. So I feel strongly that the ocean is really where you need to look for to make the big claims of what's changing in the climate system.
It is the key, but of course, media is more focused on everything we humans do on land, so it's hard to get the word out there on what's happening on the oceans.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like exploring space. There's so much of the ocean that we haven't discovered yet, but that we are starting to, which is great. We're continuously starting to get funding to put floats and buoys out that track certain systems of the ocean that we never had before. So hopefully the future brings a lot more ideas and more knowledge to the general public about what's going on in the ocean and how they're impacting it or what they may do to help out.
It's the new frontier. What will you be researching next, Paul?
Well, I'm definitely going to continue looking at the East Coast and the impacts of sea level rise there. I'm actually working right now on some things with the Southern Ocean because it's inherently tied with what's going on in the North Atlantic, believe it or not. So just trying to look at the whole world as a whole and figure out what we can all do.
Great. We've been talking with Paul Goddard from the University of Arizona. He's the lead author of the paper, An Extreme Event of Sea Level Rise Along the Northeast Coast of North America in 2009-2010. That was published February 14th, 2015 in the journal Nature Communications. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. This was great.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. I'm Alex. Check out our webpage at ecoshock.org. Look at the show blog with all the links at ecoshock.info and our busy page on SoundCloud, heading past 20,000 listeners in just our first year in the cloud. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.